So this is Module 20, Class 7, on the low-tone slogans in the mind training, mostly from this book by
Trolley Rinpoche,
The Practice of Low-Tone. And so Erica and I tonight are going to discuss dealing with adversity, transforming adversity into the path of awakening. And I'm going to sort of go through the introduction, and then Erica's going to dig into the first three slogans. Okay. I will give it my best shot. I'm going to do an introduction, and Erica will do the first three slogans in that section tonight. So I'm looking for someone who has the book to read the first paragraph on page 82. Megan, would you be?
Sure. Transforming adversity into the path of awakening. We now come to the instructions on how to train our minds amid the unfavorable and unwanted circumstances of our lives. We have been born into an imperfect world, characterized by unpredictability and adversity, as infinite human beings that have foibles, make mistakes, as finite human beings
who make mistakes
that have foibles, make mistakes, get confused, and think irrationally. There is much to contend with, and our ability to prevent or circumvent difficulties is quite limited. We aren't omnipotent beings, and while we try to protect ourselves and maintain order in our lives, we simply don't have the ability to safeguard ourselves from its disasters.
And then we have slogan number something or other, always maintain only a joyful mind. This is a good contrast to this. So actually, when Eric and I were preparing this, I started to tell her a story that I'm going to share. And it was sort of an interesting Dharma story, and the teacher was one of my students. And so I teach high school math, and I teach seniors who are in advanced placement calculus, and they're really gung-ho, very focused students who really want to do well and really want to get in college. And so they care a real lot about their grades. And the student at the end of the first quarter, I said, your average is 91, that's an A minus. After every class, he wanted to discuss that with me. And I finally said, why don't you come at the end of the day today and let's have a conversation instead of you trying to discuss this point on that test and this point. Let's talk, have a real talk. And he sat down and started to talk. And I sort of was ready to have to be sort of like, look, this is the deal. This is what's going to happen. I'm sorry that you're so worked up, but just you got to accept this. And he talked for a little, and they said, you know, there's so much that's out of my control about getting into college. I really don't know what I need to do. I don't know who's making the decision. He said, and so all I'm really trying to do is control what I can, which is the grade that I earn in this class. And I thought, like, afterwards, I was like, oh my God, like, he was 17 and a half and obsessed with college, and he saw, right, exactly what we do. Like, how often do we walk around and we think, you know, my mother, people in my mother's family had this illness, so I'm going to do all the things the doctors say, and then that will never happen to me, you know. I will take all the right vitamins, I will do the right exercises, I will do all these things, and then we probably all know somebody who probably did all those things. I mean, there's a sort of Jim Fix who was the runner, and... you know, had a heart attack. I mean, the person who does everything to be very healthy is in a car accident. I mean, there's so many things that we don't control. And then we spend our, you know, a lot of our energy, you know, trying to control things going on because we don't like the idea that there is all this adversity. It's like, that's not like we wake up in the morning and think, what's my good thought for the day? My good thought for today is there's so much adversity and so little I control. That's not how we start our day. It's like, that's my, you know, when they do that, like, positive thinking mantra, it's not that. Like, things will be. And so one question that I like the way he talked about here is, how do we, like, why can't we control everything? Why couldn't we, you know, the way, you know, the story is that the Buddha's father tried to control his environment in order to get the result he wanted. He wanted him, the prediction was at his birth, or before his birth, that he would either be a great ruler or, what was the alternative?
An ascetic.
Yeah.
A renunciate.
Right. And the father did everything he could to control that, and it didn't work. And so what he points out is, like, I could control everything that happens in my house, right? Take me to be a very different person, but I could try to control, you know, what food comes in the house, what happens to the air that comes in the house, what chemical, like everything. But I can't, because everything depends on other things. So someone walking by my house could, you know, let me take my container of toxic fumes and blow it around. I mean, I don't have that. My son decided to spray paint his costume in the house. He didn't understand well ventilated didn't mean the basement. You know, but you can't control. There's everything affects everything else. So you could be the most careful driver, the most alert person, and there could be an accident because somebody else isn't being. Okay. All the things that we can't control. And so that's kind of, there's so much that happens. We're all feeling this. Always maintain, always, only a joyful mind I can see. But the piece is to not think of it as like, oh, we're victims of fate, that every bad thing that happened to me is some, you know, fate is out there, out to get me personally. And it's really about, you know, the adversity comes. My refrigerator broke the other day. And the guy said, guess what? We can't fix it. You need a new fridge. You know, there it is. And so what do you do with it? And I didn't handle it very, I would say, particularly wisely, most of the part of the way. But you can always choose how you deal with it. Like, you'd be like angry at the person who made the refrigerator, as if what? They care. They don't care. Like, it wouldn't do anything. Or Sears, because they should have made a product that lasted 20 years, not 15 years. But what you can do when the adversity comes up is you can see, like, what's your reaction? You know, it's my reaction. This was unfair. I bought a good product. I don't have time to deal with this right now. Why isn't somebody else going to take care of all of this for me? Maybe my mother would like to come and order a fridge for me, you know. And what you get to see is your habitual patterns. How do you react to this? How do you react when, you know, I was trying to get here in time to be Umzi and Sears, which was very difficult online the other day, exactly as I'm trying to leave, calls me and the call is not working for me to find out when they're going to bring it tomorrow. And I need to know that. And then I'm like having to like sit there and figure out, you know, what do I do? Like, they could take 15 minutes and then there's no umsi here, you know. And what did I do? And I sort of got stuck. And I saw myself get stuck. And that's what happens. We can see what happens. And we start to put ourselves in like little boxes. Like, I am the person who... Like, I am the person who takes care of ordering this, and I'm going to do it really efficiently. I'm going to do a great job. And I didn't. Like, I picked, at each step of the way, when I was trying to order the new fridge, you know, and there's do this or do that. And I do this, and then, like, a minute or two later, I go, this was a bad idea. At one point, I had a person on the computer trying to help and a person on the phone. A person on the computer went away. So I was working with a person on the phone. The person on the computer came back. As this woman was almost finished helping me, I said, I got to go. The guy on the computer is going to help me. The guy on the computer was a waste. Like, bad. Okay. But I got stuck in, I'm going to take care of this. I can figure it out. I know what to do. I didn't. You know, and just sort of, you see, like, oh, that's, I like to be in charge. There was an interesting, I'm not going to get it right, an interesting expression about helping people. So I love to help people. It's like, and it said, helping is the smiling face of control.
Oh, that's good.
Something like that, right?
I just thought, can I say something?
Yeah.
So, but there's, we talk about accepting help and trust and all that sort of stuff. So if you had to wait, be a little late because the Sears was pretty immutable and flexible, there's so many people here who know how to be omzi.
Right.
It's not like, you know,
yeah, but then I was,
meditate.
What I was stuck in was also my, like, not sure how to work with my phone to do some technology stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was waiting for the guy, like he said, I'm going to put you on hold the classic minute.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm just going to put you on hold for a brief minute. And then I'm like, if I hang up, like, I'll never find out, you know, like, what will happen. So I tried texting Erica, who was still at home or something. And, no, I mean, and it was just like, even that I got in that sort of, what am I going to do? I don't know what to do style of dealing with you know, adversity for me. That kind of like not in the moment adversity. And the challenge is to even as we notice who we think we are in those moments, to really see what's happening in the moment, which can include noticing I'm not dealing with this well, or noticing I think I'm the boss of everything and I'm going to fix this because that's what I'm really, really good at. And there's a great line in here. I think this might be almost the last thing I thought of to say. So on page 85, towards the middle, there's a quote from the Wheel Weapon Mind Training. Mm-hmm. He doesn't credit the author, so let me see. That our selfish actions create a sword that returns to cut us. Somebody want to read the little quote in there?
In short, when calamities befall me, it is the weapon of my own evil deeds returned upon me, like a smith killed by his own sword. From now on, I shall be heedful of my own sinful actions.
So it's sort of that. And the piece is, you know, the sin isn't that we get frustrated or we don't handle things well. The sin is the getting attached to, this is who I am, this is how I do things. And I'm so attached to myself, I can't see what's happening. I can't see the different people I'm interacting with around this issue I had. Until, like, at the very end when I realized this computer guy was useless, and I said, look, like, I told Erica, I said, I yelled at the guy on the computer. She goes, how do you yell at someone? I had to say, all caps. Don't do anything. And I realized that when you call and you talk to someone on the phone, you can say things like, I really need you to help me. And they can hear, right? When you talk to a person and you say, I really need you to help me. I need this to be taken care of. I have to get this done. I have to get it done when I can be home and not when you want to come some random other time. And when you're doing that on the computer, the person can't hear, like your anxiety, your frustration. And to, you know, get to that point of realizing, like, yes, the computer is very efficient, except when there's no personal interaction. It's just very interesting. I mean, and this is, after the whole thing, the 2 hours I spent dealing with this on Tuesday night, I had something else to do, and I hung up, and my husband said, that seemed very stressful for a first world problem. Which it was. You know, it was not any big deal, but it was really that kind of, and so it sort of brought out for me that whole way. Here's a very little adversity, and I really struggled. And I'm not necessarily a better person for it, but that was my little, hitting my little wall.
Ba-dum-bum?
Bum.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. So, as Elise said, basically, we're constantly confronted with issues that shake us or challenge us or undermine us or that we feel undermined. And our tendency is to tighten up and try to control everything that we can so that we feel safe, we feel that the outcome is what we want. And by doing that, we fundamentally lost the ability to play with the energy that's coming at us. Our own anxiety and our fears. Which isn't to say that we're not going to feel anxiety, but over time with our practice of shamatha vipassana, we start working with the mental issues that come up, the emotional, physically embodied issues that come up. We get to know ourselves pretty well. We get to see it over and over and over again. We become familiar enough with it to not completely buy into it, and to also see that yelling at the guy on the computer or the phone just further creates tension. It further creates tension for you and for the other, for that person. And this whole path that we're on, once we've made this commitment to be a bodhisattva and to actually work with ourselves so we're not contributing to the shit that is being piled on everywhere. Once we've made that commitment, we have to stop. We have to do the best we can to know ourselves and not contribute this kind of pollution again and again. Mm-hmm. And these lojong is kind of like the driver's manual for bodhisattva practice. It really is sort of like, well, when this happens...
Maybe we should say what a bodhisattva is.
So there are some people here who... Hello.
Hi.
I'm Erica, by the way.
Hi.
And I've met you before, I think, no?
I'm not sure. Who was your last week? Pete.
Pete. And you are?
Linda.
Hi, Linda.
Hello.
And...
Oh, I'm Lauren.
Hi, Lauren. So welcome. In terms of the Buddhist path, the bodhisattva path is fundamentally you kind of become a bodhisattva, or you aspire to being a person who fundamentally not only doesn't cause suffering for other people, but in some way you make a commitment that your behavior, in fact, you'll do your very best to make alleviate suffering of other people, not just yourself. And when you see that if you're yelling and screaming at somebody because they didn't make your coffee right, you're creating a problem. You're not contributing in any way to anybody's sense of relaxation or peace in this world. And so many of us are reacting that way that you can see what kind of mess we create over and over and over again anyway. So that's like the shortest definition of bodhisattva activity you will ever get anywhere. There's billions and trillions of words written about this, and we can talk about it further if you're interested. And we're going to be studying this, but these particular teachings that we're studying now at the Lojong are actual ways that we can work with experience on the spot, so that we can cut the velocity of our own passion, aggression, and ignorance, our own sort of ways of acting. If the world, in fact, isn't all about me, if, in fact, we get that and we see how what suffering other people are going through, because we recognize our own suffering, then we make a commitment to try to be as mindful as possible, not to contribute to confusion. And every one of our experiences is unique. Your situation that you go through when you get home, your situation, mine, everybody's path will be unique. But because of the nature of ourselves as humans on the path, we share this tendency to try to, as Elise said, to control everything as much as we can. And by doing that, we can really be bullies in our world. We can really miss an opportunity when somebody needs our support or needs to be heard properly. We can miss that because we're so preoccupied with our own anxiety, fear of the unknown. And as if we know anything on this particular path, we can barely control it. We can't control. We can control the tiniest little bit. We all know we're born. We all know we're going to get, if we're lucky, we'll get old. And we all know we're going to kick the bucket. Nobody knows when. But those are truths. And in the framework of that, how can we be kind and work with each other in a generous way? So, it's kind of outrageous. It's kind of anti-American in a way, like that I can't have everything that I want, you know, when I want it, how I want it. It's kind of it's an insult in a way. But once you finally see that, it's actually, you can begin to relax and actually enormous space opens up and your heart opens up. And these Lojong slogans are kind of guides for that. And the ones that I'm going to talk about this evening, and I hope we all will talk about, are, from my point of view, they're really insulting. And they're really hard. Some of you certainly haven't read the material, but have many of you read it, been able to read it? Some of him, some of it. We're talking about number 11. And again, Zali said it's in this book, The Practice of Lojong, but I'm also referring to this book, which we've mentioned, Training the Mind, which is discussing the same material, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Trungpa Rinpoche says number 11 is, when beings in the world are filled with evil, transform unfavorable circumstances into the path of enlightenment. Another way of saying it is, when the world is filled with evil, transform all mishaps onto the path of bodhi, or the path of wakefulness. So, as Elise's adventures with her refrigerator and her the computer guy and the phone guy, all along the way, the world is just going poke, poke, poke. And she's going, but what she is doing at the same time is acknowledging her mental, the kerfluffle that's going on in her head. So in fact, instead of just calling the guy on the computer or the guy on the phone a four-letter word, what she's doing is she's using this experience to learn more about herself. And that's what makes it path. That's the difference between it being just a big mess. And what makes it your path is that you actually are, every experience that arises is an opportunity to know more about your own habitual ways of reacting and to actually, it's slightly funny, actually, if you think about it, which is a great relief. From my perspective,
what would you say though about the when the world is filled with evil?
Well, and you see, this
because this didn't sound like evil. No. I mean, it's just the circumstances of the refrigerator. So, how would you speak to that?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I mean,
planned.
I have difficulty with the word evil personally. Does anybody else here?
Yeah. No, not anymore.
You don't. because
perfect.
The refrigerator situation, that's not an evil situation.
But you know what's interesting about it is my husband made calls ahead because the repair guy said, look, you just need to buy a new one. Look, here didn't have. So I said, Sears, we bought from Sears. Sears will be fine. Not to disparage Sears. And then my husband called Sears, and they said, if you come in and get a Sears card, you can get this price. Otherwise, you have to order online or on the phone to get this really good discounted price. You can't come in the store. And then we decided we didn't want to go to the store. It would be too much trouble. And afterwards, I realized, if we could have got the same price, which maybe we could have, if you interact with the person in the store, they don't, automatically do things. Like, you can say, have you done this yet? Oh, okay. No problem. You know.
So
the evil almost is the way that so little of this is now you go into a store and talk to a person who cares about your experience.
Okay, yes. But there was evil 2,500 years ago, but it looked different.
It did.
And it looked different 500 years ago. And this sort of, how do you deal with this outrage of being not confirmed, of an obstacle? I'll get back to the actual evil that you're referring to. Oh, that this is a very human condition that we've all, that has been experienced throughout history. And the background is that we've looked at everybody and we've said that even the worst human being in the world has Buddha nature.
Right.
Even the most dangerous orange people that some of us might know about have
somewhere in there
have Buddha nature, basic goodness. And we are not separate from them. And our experience of anger and opposition actually is kind of like it enables us to know them better. So there's some sort of sympathy, and it becomes less an us versus them situation. None of this is easy. This is the real part that it isn't sort of like, oh, I get that. And it comes up again and again and again that this sort of insult to your sense of control and permanence happens again and again. I'd like to take your question and ask the room, what does evil mean to, in this context, to you, to anybody here? When the world is filled with evil,
what's the rest of the sentence?
I'm sorry?
What's the rest of the sentence?
I'll get it. transform unfavorable circumstances into the path of enlightenment. And this is a different language with Jigme Trungpa Rinpoche, transform all mishaps. So there's quite a different flavor to these onto the path of Bodhi or wakefulness. How do we do that?
Where are they saying that? I mean, I don't know whether it matters in terms of the practice, but it sounds to me like their mishaps is one thing, which could be, I think, the refrigerator thing, and evil is another thing, which I don't know if they explain, but I think many people or cultures have some sense of what evil is, sort of trying to intentionally harm others rather than, you know, just being incompetent or something. But maybe it's the same practice in terms of not taking it personally and turning it into wakefulness.
And how would you do that? How would you turn it into wakefulness?
Oh, I don't know.
For yourself? And how would you say you were confronted with a person? How would you relate with that? And I'm not being all Pollyanna about this. Like,
yeah.
If somebody's coming at you with a knife, you say, are you sure you want to do that? It might not be the... I'm not recommending that, but I'm saying, how would we do that?
I mean, the situation if someone's actually coming at you to harm you?
I just threw that out. Because I think we can get really kind of like dreamy Buddhist-y about all this. And like, we'll just be really nice. And,
well, we had... I forget what it was called, but we had about... Was it skillful means?
Correctamundo. There you go.
The right thing at the right time.
That's
so if you're really awake in the moment, you do what you need to do, which would be get out of there if someone's trying to hurt you or whatever, and then you're just, and then you deal with the other feelings later.
How do we find skillful means? How do we know how to behave in those sorts of situations?
Well, if you're really present, if you're present, then you just see what's going on, not what you think is going on or what you wish would be going on, and you react appropriate. You do what needs to be done, basically, at the moment.
Yeah, that's exactly the prescription.
But I also think like that experience is at work. I can't see it in the moment, and for me, like, as long as I continue to look at it until there's things, like, until there are no more meanings that come out, then I usually can find meanings that I didn't find in the moment. So that is a situation at work where, to make a long story short, I basically had all these things in my mind and then was sort of stuck in that position, and then after this investor talked about something else, like opened up a world. So when I got that, then I was able to look back at my behavior. Like, I think it's a willingness to look back at your behavior. And I look back and realize I had built up this whole like castle of non-truths that was so strong
about this other person.
Yeah. And once I was sort of released, because she brought some new information in, which, you know, it wasn't even so much that her point was right, but I was able to see a glimpse that she had another view, then, like, all the walls of the castle came down, and I could see that I had manufactured the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, that she was partially right, and we were partially right, but I was so, like, resentful and angry, and she's going to get me fired, all this stuff, and I realized, like, she's a CPA just doing her job. And so I think for me, like, I can't always see things in the moment, but like as long as I'm willing to continue to look until I can see something that I didn't see, or I can know the truth in my heart, then I think I think it's if you can turn adversity into enlightenment. I always think like enlightenment and realize like, and I also realized that in presenting it to the partner, that I didn't give him the right view because I had manufactured.
Wow.
And so now going forward, when I have a situation like that, I'm going to give him, that's just the view that I want. I'm going to give him the whole view. So I think as long as you, and it's never too late to look back at something that you did or said and get more meaning out of it. So.
But I think that's, you're exactly on target. I think that's what we can.
View, look, continuing to
view
look.
View is exactly the point. Yeah. It's a wider view than our own self-interest.
Yeah.
And how do that is so, we're so unfamiliar with, we're not encouraged, except sort of lip service-y, to really look at this world from any perspective except from our own self-interest. And that's why it's kind of revolutionary to actually be willing to do what you did. And you learn something about yourself, and it became part of your path.
But the thing is, what was interesting, like you just said, like willing to do it. But the thing is, like in the weirdest way, like I didn't do anything. Like somehow something, like let go, which I didn't even think about, and all of a sudden it just came to me without thinking. And I realized, like what I had done was like, wow, I built this. So it's almost like it's sort of like it came from my body. And then into my mind, it could interpret it.
It came versus, from it all, came the, for all the came practice from, and the effort
right.
you've been making up to that point, actually. Yeah. So I see what you're saying.
Versus the castle was right. all manufactured right. up here. Right. But the truth was like man came from like mm-hmm. here, and then it went mm-hmm. up here. But 99% of the time I'm up here. But yeah. there are times when, rare times when I can... do it like that, but this is a really clear thing. And then I look back in some of the interactions I had with the partner for months and months and months. I was doing the same thing, and I finally let go. Like, you know, so I was able to look back in 6 months or a year ago, see the same thing. So I have to just be careful. Like when I'm putting things here first, if I don't wait for what's coming here, it's going to be really. It's going to be a good result.
You remind me that in this book, Rinpoche talks about it isn't as though you disappear, mm-hmm. but you start to see where your ego mm-hmm. trip wants to take over, and you can let that one, it becomes clearer and clearer, and that's what you let go of. But as it mm-hmm. shows up, yeah, yeah. In terms of actual evil,
there was something that came up later in the chapter that really stood out to me that I felt like connected with that, where he made reference to the word devil, which is like a classic
or demons.
That is, well, there was that one yeah. with Milarepa, and yeah. then there on page 116 actually where. There's the reference of the devil. That which is called the devil is not some actual great big black thing that scares and petrifies whomever it seems. A devil is anything that obstructs the achievement of freedom, which I thought was a really
yeah.
nice way to look at it, because freedom, you know, you could interpret that as a lot of things. It could be anything that you're grasping at, that you're fixated on, that's preventing you from being present, or that's creating your own suffering, or is creating suffering for other people. I thought that was kind of an interesting
yeah.
way to think about
yeah.
it.
There's another line right after he says, mm-hmm. most of all, there's Evil. No greater devil than this fixation to a self.
Hmm.
Right. And he says that again and again throughout this chapter. I think all we get to work with is our lives right here, right now. We can't fix everything that we see is dangerous. We can do one thing that's in front of us, and then the next thing, and the next thing on a very... very, it's okay to do things on a very human level. Right. in all that war, one of the slogans for Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's was victory over war. So, yeah, wonderful. I want to make sure that we just talk about the other two. Another fun one. Drive all blames into one. So, I'd love to know what your response to that was. It's not easy. It's much easier to say, you screwed up. It's your fault. Right? And how do we, in a situation where it's like this, as Jeff was sort of saying, how do we release this aggression, this confrontation? The method seems to be, if you take it upon yourself to drop the aggression, the space opens up and anything is possible. Did anybody have a reaction to this particular slogan? It's an insult, because you want to say to somebody, that's our fearless leader right now is really in the habit of never taking responsibility for, sort of, it's out there, it's everybody else's fault. So what it mean to drive all blames into one, by which I mean me?
Oneself.
Oneself.
So to say, the refrigerator was the easy hassle I had this week. The hard one was that I was trying to help my mom with something, and there are three sisters. I have two sisters, and one of them worked with me on trying to figure something out, and I thought we did a great thing of how great we worked as we figured this all out. We called, and we made all the calls, and I CC'd the third sister on this. There's two brothers who they're just happy if anybody does anything. They could care less. The third sister, like the next morning in the middle of the class, I look and there's a text. I'm like, thanks a lot for just CCing me and not even talking to me about it.
Yeah.
You can't win.
And I was, and it's just, it was one of those things where you're like, I just did all this good stuff and nobody appreciates me and all the good things I do. And I was really grateful that my other sister just sent off an email that sort of maybe covered it, but I so wanted to like write back and say, I just did all this good stuff and you should just,
you should thank me.
You should be thanking me for all the wonderful things I do, and just...
And everybody is doing exactly that.
Right.
We all want somebody to say, you did such a good job.
I know, and I just...
And you're just the best.
And I really had to, like, work so hard at, like working on the slogan to, at the very least, not drive all blames into someone. Like, to just not... The best I could do was not respond at that point. Because I just felt like I had a hard time thinking of a way to say, like, I'm sorry that in my incredibly busy day I didn't also call you. Would you have liked me to call you at 11:30 when I finally got done with everything else? But I didn't. But it is. It's so much when someone says, you hurt me, you want to say, but I'm a good person.
But.
I'm a nice person.
I wanted to talk about those four demons. Because struck me that, I wonder, what are we talking about, four demons? Was anybody else curious about that? I was sure somebody would be curious.
Where is this?
It's page 253.
253.
What?
In the notes.
Oh, in the notes. Oh.
Just, I was like,
what?
We were supposed to read the whole book.
What are you talking about?
Well,
253.
The four Maras.
Mm-hmm. The four demons.
Mm-hmm. Would somebody like to read? It's number 13. On page 253, the footnote.
Oh my goodness.
Four demons are as follows. The demon of the aggregates.
Which is the skandhas, which we discussed.
The demon of the conflicting emotions. The demon of the lord of death. And the demon of the sons of gods. The demon of the aggregates is so called because without the five aggregates, there would be no basis for the sufferings of samsara. The demon of the conflicting emotions arises from a belief in a self and gives rise to negative actions. The demon of the lord of death refers to impermanence and the fact of the inevitability of death. The demon of the sons of the gods prevents us from proceeding to nirvana through distraction, attachment, and fixation.
No, it's not my fault. It's theirs.
It's what?
It's not my fault. It's their fault.
So here we go. Basically, this is saying that because we think of ourselves as solid, permanent, and unchanging, that is the basis for all of this. So demons is a funny language. I mean, we're not saying they're demons, but this is the language that they're using. It's that because we think of ourselves in these solid, permanent, unchanging ways, which we've discussed, and we are not, we fixate on ourselves and we create enormous we create enormous suffering because of that false belief. And that this is the thread throughout the Buddhist practice and throughout Lojong practice. This is the basis. We have to remember that the basis is the non-existent of a permanent self who wins every argument, is best in show every time, is smarter than anybody else, and bigger and better and badder. So drive all blames into one self is a very bitter pill for people to have to take if they feel themselves as being having those characteristics.
I always have the question, and I'll just continue to ask it, which is, in some ways I kind of know this, in other ways I just feel like I need to ask this question, which is, and this is where discernment, I know, comes into play, where, you know, what if there is some harm that is being done, and where's the fine line between being a doormat and being like, okay, I need to learn, soften up here and accept and see where, you know, how, what my part in this is.
What do you think?
I think it's, for me, it's one of my cutting edges. I feel like it really has to be about discernment and taking time to really hear what is really going on, and to be honest with myself, and then and also not get attached to the drama of whatever it is that may be arising.
Yeah. There's no recommendation to be a doormat in Dharma. I've never...
Right.
I mean, to be guileless and to be ignorant in that sense, right? You, on some level, this is all about getting rid of the extraneous stuff, mm-hmm. so that the true wisdom shines through. It's like in the sadhana, Mahamudra, that you actually know what is true. And you can act on that. So if somebody's being inappropriate, you can actually
cut without, like a knife.
Without aggression, cut the whole thing. Without, you don't need to devastate somebody. You cut it. And you cut it because there's no hesitation when you see what is accurate, what's inaccurate. And you know, you, yes?
No, but like you have the that little bit of gap or distance or something enough that it would be, it would just seem, oh, why are they treating me that way? It just wouldn't get to bounce off or something. And then probably your reaction of being sort of surprised that somebody would treat you that way, probably has some, they would notice that, and that could have some effect. Break the cycle or something, possibly.
I think this is why they call it a path. It's because it isn't like that we, all of a sudden we know this. We sort of, it's sort of like a, as it gets warmer, you more clothes come off. You just don't need that. You know what is true. And you trust yourself. And this is what where I really think that he addresses very well in this chapter. You don't throw, it isn't as though you disappear and become a pile of gelatinousness that is just sort of flopping from place to place. There's a real willingness. You're cutting away these sort of extraneous, habitual chatter so that what is true becomes very, very clear. You're developing wisdom. And you can't develop wisdom without the effort that goes into it. It just doesn't come full blown.
My understanding of the take all the blames to yourself is that even as you recognize that somebody might have done something that's unwholesome, not with the attitude of, oh, I would never do that. You know, that sense of separation where
yes.
I know that under the right circumstances I could do a lot of things and so could most other people. So, you know, always to be aware of, for me, you know, how this, just this much space between what I can do and what the other.
Thank you. Yeah, that, I'm glad you said that, because what we're actually talking about is cutting away the I, other, wall that we keep putting up, this sort of separation that, you know, and what you're saying is that that separation between I and other is very thin, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
I've read, I don't know if the Buddha really said this, because I haven't come across it in scriptures, but this thing that, you know, he said, the only difference between the murderer and me is that I know, you know, that I can be a murderer, but the murderer doesn't know he can be a Buddha, right?
Yeah.
Yes,
I like it.
He doesn't know he can be a what?
Huh? A Buddha.
No.
A Buddha.
Yeah. I think Roberta had something.
No, I was, you know, thinking about what Megan said about when do I need to soften up and when do I, you know, slide into being a doormat, and where's that fine line? And I don't know, my question is this related to idiot compassion? I mean, to allow people to abuse us.
Good.
Who?
Sure.
You know, Michael Levin has brought this up with me.
Yeah.
And is it related?
What do you think?
I would think, yes, that's what it seems like.
Could you describe idiot compassion for those who aren't familiar with the term?
I guess I think idiot compassion is when you're saying, oh, this poor person is, you know, he's had a hard time, so he can crap on me all he wants. Mm-hmm. So you feel sorry for someone who's acting very badly and also not taking responsibility.
And it doesn't help. There's no benefit you're giving. You're
yes, you just say, oh, this person, poor thing. You know,
You're being super understanding,
yeah,
where actually clarity could be more helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there was one point that he made in the context of this discussion that I was really glad that the way he articulated it, which was, it's really easy to misinterpret the slogan and to say, well, great, now I'm blaming myself for everything.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's not what we're saying. We're not the doormat, but we are looking at what's my role in the experience, and it's recognizing the interrelatedness of everything, not the I and the other, like you said, but it's all connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very clear in that.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever heard it quite that clearly.
Yeah, because if you just read the slogan kind of on its own, without context, it's like, oh, all right, well, I guess everything's my fault.
Yeah, and it is. And in fact, what it does, if you notice, if you try this, and I really recommend you try it, actually, experiment with this, because what you find is that something, the space opens up, this kind of dynamic of, and when you go, I'm sorry, or, you know, I'm sorry that I, or whatever you need to, it changes, which I suspect you experienced.
But
it changes the whole situation.
The notion of driving all blames to into oneself has to do with just basically moving blame out of the situation. Mm-hmm. When blame is not the issue, then we can actually see the actual dynamic. I mean, you were getting at that when you were saying, Michael. You know, that actually it's just remove, and actually, for those of us who have learned about Tonglen, this is precisely what's going on with Tonglen practice, is just pulling the blame out of the situation. So we're not on this crusade to reform the world.
The willingness to be the one, the willingness to actually do the activity, if you could call it that, of dropping it.
Well, yeah.
That's our training as Buddhists.
By pulling the blame out of the situation, then we can actually investigate what really is going on. And we can actually come together, if you're involved in a relationship with someone, a situation, where you actually do understand what's going on. And there's more and more basic sympathy at that point, which can help to find a remedy or a way to get through the whole process.
The antidote to it for immediate compassion is to have compassion for yourself too, right? It's not compassion if you only have it for the other.
I think that's always in there. I agree,
In Sharon Salzberg's book, there's this thing where you're in a boat, you and two other people, and one has to be thrown out because the boat would sink. And what is the answer? Who are you going to throw out? Or who's going? And if you say yourself, that's the wrong answer. If you can so easily kind of dismiss yourself out of the picture. All of us deserve the same compassion. And if you're making yourself a doormat, then you haven't compassion for yourself.
Yes. We have 2 minutes to discuss the other insulting slogan here, or insulting to ego, which is be grateful to everyone, or meditate on the great kindness of everyone. That's a hard one to swallow. Anybody have any feelings about that one?
Well, I find this personally very irritating. But I think what it does is shows, the point of it is to show where we get irritated by seeing our own reaction to some situation that's painful or difficult. So the kindness, it's not that that person is necessarily being kind or kind to us, but the situation gives us a chance to work with our own reactions to whatever's happening.
And everyone you meet is your teacher.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yes, that's a very good way to put it.
Yeah.
They also, Pema has a really good, her chapter, she says, if we were to come up with one word about each of the troublemakers in our lives, we would find ourselves with a list of descriptions of our own rejected qualities, which we project onto the outside world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great.
I couldn't say it any better than that. I think that's where it brings in that they actually were actually grateful to the irritation to enable us, as you were saying, to observe our own habitual responses and grasping or fear it's a perfect manure on the field of Bodhi, I'd say. So that's it.
So I just want to say that next week Michael Fagan's going to lead, and we're going to skip some slogans now but come back to them later. So next week, November 9th, will be point 5, evaluation of mind training, slogans 19 through 22. And so we're not following everything sequentially, but there is actually a logic in there somewhere. We'll figure it out.